and I've got one left to do. So this is it. Number 14 of Here Comes the Judge. Now, I have learned quite a bit in preparing to do this series, and the objective of doing this series really was just to get a fresh look at the book of Daniel, because when I started this, the year 2000 hadn't gotten here yet. There was all of the noise in the air about what's going to happen, and oh, woe is us, because, you know, this is going to happen, and that's going to happen. I'm still trying to, this is still December, and maybe something is yet to happen, but I don't know of anything. I've read a lot of things that people talk about, well, this happened and so forth, because they've got to justify all of the excitement that they generated about what was going to happen, the catastrophic chaos that we were going to experience. So I thought perhaps we should go through the book of Daniel to find out what the book is all about, since it's allegedly a book of prophecy. And it talks in the last chapter, which we're going to look at today, about the end of days. So there must be something here that could help us prepare for the end of days, and that's why I decided to go through the series. And in going through it, I discovered some things. Just to bring us back up to speed before we end this presentation, last time I stopped in verse 40 of chapter 11. And so we're going to proceed through and make our way to the end of the 12th chapter. But just to bring us back into focus, this revelatory message that we see in the book of Daniel is about the present, the past, and the future. Now, that's not normally the way you say it. You normally say past, present, and future. But the book of Daniel and the things that are written there are about the present, the time in which he lived, the past, and the future. You have to take it in that order, because what Daniel sees has to apply to his present circumstance. The revelation that comes to him has to do, especially this revelation in chapters 10 through 12, has to do with a question that he had. And it's a question that I've repeated, and I repeat again to you, because sometimes we take things out of context so unconcernedly that we miss what is really important here. In the case of Daniel, his abiding question is the same kind of question any of us would have if we found ourselves in the circumstance that Daniel found himself in, of being taken away from his homeland, winding up as a slave, essentially, or a servant, a captive, if you will, in Babylon. Now, Daniel lived quite a long time, because he not only survived the fall of the Babylonian Empire, he lived into the Medes and the Persian Empire with Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. These are kings that the Bible refers to. Now, in living such a long time, when he went into captivity at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, he was a studious individual, and one of the things that I pointed out in the last episode of the presentation on Daniel, number 13, one of the things that Nebuchadnezzar would have taken from the temple would be the scrolls, would be the things that are written down, in particular the things that Jeremiah wrote down, because Jeremiah was the prophet who had had prophesied, is the best term, under the inspiration of God, about the fall of Judah. You're going to go into captivity because you're just not right. And so, in going into captivity, and Daniel having access to the material that had been taken by Nebuchadnezzar, one of the scrolls had this information about how long the captivity of Judah would exist. And so Daniel had a natural question. How long? Is it about time? He found in Jeremiah, the 29th chapter, I believe it is, a statement that it would be 70 years. And so he was approaching the 70-year end of this captivity when he began to raise the question. In chapter 9 of Daniel, we have the prayer that he prays. And in that prayer, he gives an intercessory prayer on behalf of the people for their sins, as well as his own personal repentance and acknowledgement of his own sin. And so he sees this vision that begins in chapter 10, and he's visited by angels, well, several messengers, and one appears to be the Son of God who comes to him to give him information about the answer to his question. How long? How long, O Lord? So when we say that this revelatory message is about the present, the past, and the future, it's because the present was his immediate concern. How long are we going to be in the circumstance in which we find ourselves? Now, the answer that comes to him is staggering. I won't try to go back and reiterate the things that we've covered. You can get those tapes that deal with chapter 10 and chapter 11 so that you can perhaps refresh your memory on it. But when he gets this answer, he's confused by it. He doesn't understand what it all means. And we covered that in chapter 10 in particular, how the explanation is given to him by the angels. And it goes on and on to chapter 12, and yet he still doesn't understand. Daniel has some confusion. Now, I got to tell you, if Daniel is confused by it, how is it that so many people think they have the answer? Are some of these people closer to God than Daniel? How many of these people have been visited by angels with explanations about what he sees in vision, and yet he still doesn't comprehend it? And yet we've got lots of people who know. And they tell you very clearly what it all means. Now, I stand here today to tell you I don't know what it all means. And there are some things in chapter 12 about some numbers of days that I don't know. I just don't know how to discern it. I've heard a lot of people claim that they know. In fact, I was thinking as I toiled, you know, with how to make this presentation today. Some of you have been around a long time. I remember 1972 in January, sitting in the auditorium, actually it was the gymnasium at Ambassador College, as we had this big meeting about what everybody had hoped was the announcement that we were preparing to flee because of the predictions based on what people thought they knew about things written in Daniel. It was time to flee because we had always said that in 1972, you just do the math and take you back to that period of time, the countdown, that 3.5 year period that's talked about in the book of Daniel will begin. And so by 1975, Jesus would be standing on the earth. Now, far be it for me to ever say that anybody ever proclaimed that we never set any dates. But we set a whole lot of dates, foolishly and arrogantly, because everybody likes to think, well, we may not know the day or the hour, but we can figure out the month and the year. No, you can't do that. You cannot figure that thing out, and there are people still to this day insisting that they can nail it down. But the most important thing to extract from the book of Daniel has nothing to do with figuring out who the beast is, who the false prophet is, and what the time sequences are. It has nothing to do with that. And as we finish this presentation, perhaps we will nail it down in our own minds. Now, the present for Daniel was this overriding concern about when he would be able to return to his homeland. Now, I believe that Daniel, in the process of receiving all of this, did return to his homeland. I mentioned this back in a previous sermon. If you turn back to Nehemiah, and chapter 10, I believe that Daniel, along with the Hebrew boys and others who had been captive in Babylon and ultimately held over by the the new empire of the Medes and the Persians, were able to return to Jerusalem after the end of the 70 years. Because that was the promise that was written down in the book of Jeremiah. Chapter 10 has some names mentioned. In verse 2, we have Azariah. We have Jeremiah's name mentioned. In chapter verse 5, we have Obadiah's name mentioned. These are all, certainly Jeremiah and Obadiah are prophets, but also verse 6 has Daniel's name mentioned as one of those who was the signer of the covenant about how the people were going to live, having been able to return under Ezra and Nehemiah to Jerusalem from their captivity. So Daniel got a chance to return. Did he stay in Jerusalem? I'm guessing that he did not, because he winds up going back and working in concert, not so much in concert, but the book of Daniel and the passages that he read or wrote down have him living in a palace or a home up in the area where the Medes and the Persians were in control. So did he go back and forth? I can't tell you, because there is no real record in the scriptures as to what happened. But we do see, as according to Nehemiah, that Daniel was able to return to his homeland. So the present question in his mind had an ending, shall we say. It had a fulfillment. But the future issue of his question, has Daniel being revealed, having something revealed to him that is so staggering, which is probably why he did not understand what he was seeing. And we'll see as we proceed. Now, let's move into our presentation today. In verse 40 of chapter 11, this is this long presentation about the battles between the king of the north and the king of the south. Now, I have told you, and history records for us, that the king of the north had to do with the Seleucids. This was when the Greek Empire was split up after the death of Alexander the Great. There were four generals that wound up taking over territory, and two of them became prominent, Seleucid and Ptolemy. These were the king of the north was Seleucid, and the king of the south was the Ptolemies. The Ptolemies were in Egypt. Seleucids were in Antioch or Syria. So that's how you position it on the map. Now, they raged back and forth in battle, and the king of the north basically was winning. And it turned out, over time, history records and tells us it was Antiochus Epiphanes the fourth, the god manifest, as he called himself. Had so much audacity that he put it on the coins of money, you know, God manifest, that's me. I'm the bad dude in town. On the other side, he had Zeus, who was one of the pagan gods of the Greek world. So he had a sense of his greatness and his descendants, and the battles went back and forth and back and forth. And during that period of time, as recorded in the 11th chapter of Daniel, we also have the revelation of people called the Maccabees. Now, they are not named in this chapter, but history records that the Maccabees, during that intertestamental period of time of about 600 years, had great battles trying to survive the onslaught of not only the Greeks, but after the Greeks fell, the Romans also interceded into the Palestinian area. And during that period of time between the Old Testament and the New Testament, Daniel records some of the battles in vision in this 11th chapter, and this is what's being explained to him. Not so much by the names of the people. Alexander's name is not here. Antiochus Epiphanes' name is not here. But history, and this is where the past comes in, you can go back in our place in history today and look and see these things having happened as they were predicted to Daniel. But with the confusion still in his mind, we come to verse 40. At the time of the end. Well, that's a powerful statement. It's repeated several times, not only in the book of Daniel, but other places about the time of the end of days. Now, some people have looked at this verse to say, well, the time of the end is the time of the end of that period of time historically dealing with the Greeks and Alexander the Great and Antiochus Epiphanes, and that's what it means by the time of the end. But when you read on, you realize that that can't be true, because there are some stipulations here about great battles and the end of days. The end of days has a sound application to it, because end of what days? Whose days? The end of the people of history, or is it a future thing that Daniel is seeing? Well, as we read on here, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. And I've heard this passage preached many, many times before we ever heard of Saddam Hussein. And there were predictions as to who this applies to. Well, I don't know. There are people who insist that the king of the south, and you know Baghdad and Iraq is south of Jerusalem, and so there's this notion that Saddam Hussein must be the king of the south. And he decides to flex his muscles, and what muscles would he have? Well, he did flex the muscles back during the Gulf War, you know, and people were getting awfully nervous about it. It was the end of time. And the end of days were here, because the king of the south has revealed himself, and he's going to control the oil of the Middle East. And in so doing it, he's going to put a stranglehold on Europe, because Europe is more dependent on the oil than we are, though we are dependent upon it, but it's going to really upset the apple cart. Well, a little fly in the ointment comes along. Well, Sodom gets defeated, and it doesn't happen, and so he doesn't look like the king of the south at this point in time. Now, what does he have up his sleeve if he is in fact the king of the south? I don't know. Does he have atomic weapons or hydrogen weapons? I don't know. Perhaps that's something you kind of look at and watch, but whether he is the king of the south or some other person, because really, if we remember, the king of the south always referred to Egypt. That's where the Ptolemies, who were the king of the south, existed. Now, maybe we ought to be paying a little more attention over there than over in Iraq. Maybe. Just a possibility. The king of the north was always the Seleucid kingdom with their capital in Antioch. And yet we like to look further north to places like Berlin and Germany in our projections of who these people might be. All I am suggesting to you is that the locations of the north and the south are in relationship to Jerusalem. So every thing that we look at in that regard has to do with that relationship to the north and the south. So, who the king of the north is and who the king of the south is, I don't know. Can't tell you. Don't have a revelation to you for you on that. But you do kind of watch the whole area, and you do consider what's going on. So, there's going to be this pushing and shoving back and forth, and what is the carrot in the Middle East? Well, oil is a big one. Certainly, that's a huge thing. Who controls that? Well, Egypt doesn't have any oil. That's amazing that they don't have any. But there is a lot of oil in other places, like you know, the Sinai Peninsula, and of course where Iraq and Iran and all of those places are. Now, I don't know if Egypt is going to be so strong and so tough that they're going to take over something. I don't know, because there are some things named here as we read on through verses 41, 42, and 43. He, that is the king of the north, shall enter also into the glorious land, and the glorious land is a reference to Jerusalem or Judea, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom. We've thought that that has a reference to Turkey. And Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon, that's Jordan. The capital of Jordan is Ammon. And the Jordanian people are the result of Lot having sex with his two daughters, and the two children born were named Moab and Ammon. Back in Genesis, that's a long time ago, but that's how the Ammonites and the Moabites came into existence. And they dwell in that land, and they are there to this very day in the presence of the Jordanian people. And he, the king of the north, shall stretch forth his hand also upon these the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Egypt is where the king of the south exists, so the king of the north is going to be victorious over the king of the south. And he shall have power over the treasures of gold and over silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. There is going to be a lot of unrest in the Middle East. Now, why do we always say, watch the Middle East? Well, here's an example. Jesus Christ even said it himself, you know, to watch Jerusalem. When the army shall surround Jerusalem, and this is a description of armies battling all around Jerusalem, pay attention. Watch it carefully. He doesn't say identify, you know, ahead of time who's doing what. But a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to figure that out, as if that's going to be some beacon to salvation. It won't save you. Knowledge like that will not save anybody. Just to know, well, yep, I've identified who the beast is and who the false prophet are and those kinds of things. That doesn't bring you salvation. We'll find out as we proceed what brings you salvation. But tidings out of the east and out of the north, I would surmise that to mean northeast, shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacle, his tents, his places of dwelling, and of his palace between the seas of the glorious holy mountain, Jerusalem again. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Now, this description of the battles that went on has happened. There was a battle with Antiochus Epiphanes around 168 BC. All of that did happen. But I have a feeling that Daniel, who never lived to see Antiochus Epiphanes, never lived to see Alexander the Great, was troubled by what all of that meant. Because in realizing that Daniel was able to go back to Jerusalem, that there was given freedom by Cyrus for the remnant to go back to Jerusalem, certainly he would be confused if he realized, well, part of the promise of us coming back to our homeland has been fulfilled, but what does all this other stuff mean? And as I said, he didn't live to see this great Antiochus Epiphanes, which is a description that we have here of the battles between the king of the north and king of the south, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies fighting back and forth over the many, many years, an expensive proposition requiring the need for gold that they could find in a place like Egypt and a place like Jerusalem and so forth. So, how are we to understand these passages? Do they have a future application? Well, the phrase in verse 40, the time of the end, comes into play. It is not the time of the end for Antiochus Epiphanes, for time goes on. People continue to exist. In Daniel's prophecy, or in the book of Daniel, not only is he revealed things about the Greek Empire, but he's also revealed things about the Roman Empire, which at the time of Daniel, he would not even have heard of. They were not even in existence. The Greeks have got to rise to eminence and prominence, and then the Romans have to conquer them. So Daniel is not even going to be around at what is described as the time of the end, and the Roman Empire existed for 1,000 years. That's a long time. And yet Daniel is given something about the end of time, or the time of the end. Well, in the first three verses of chapter 3 is the conclusion of what starts out in chapter 10 about this future thing that's going to happen, the answer to his ultimate question, how long, O Lord? And what Daniel is revealed, what is revealed to him, is something that I'm glad about, but I'm sure that he was confused about. Verse 1 of chapter 12, and at the time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of your people. Now, Daniel, who's Daniel's people? Who are they? Well, they're the Jews. But if they were only the Jews, there are some descriptions here that come along that tell us that Daniel's people comprise more than what he thought. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. Now, that's a description that Jesus used in Matthew 24 about the time of the end. There shall be a time of trouble such as has never existed, and if those days were not shortened, all life would be destroyed from the earth. Jesus said that in the Olivet prophecy. So here is Daniel being told by an angelic messenger of such a time of trouble is going to come. Now, was this time in his lifetime? Perhaps you would think that Nebuchadnezzar rolling in and carrying people captive away, but that's past. Nebuchadnezzar is dead. The Babylonian Empire is gone, and now he's under the Medes and Persian, where there is kindness towards the remnant of God's people who are allowed to go back to Jerusalem. Surely this cannot have an application of the horrible time that Daniel has written about, or that he's being told about. There has to be a future situation. And at that time, your people shall be delivered. Well, but Daniel has been allowed through Cyrus, and the remnant have been allowed to go back to Jerusalem. Is this the application, or is there something future about your people being delivered? Remember back in the 9th chapter in verse 2. In the first year of his reign, this is the reign of Darius the Mede, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years whereof the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet, that we would that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolation of Jerusalem. So this, of what Daniel is talking about here, cannot be about those 70 years. It can't be about that end of time, end of that captivity. It has to be something more. And in this statement about, at that time your people shall be delivered, whose people? Just the Jews of that time? Or is Daniel associated with another group of people? Let's read on. Everyone that shall be found written in the book. Whoa. The book. What book? Well, Revelation, the 7th chapter. Let's turn back there and see some references to a phrase like that. The Revelation 7 and verse 4. Talking about numbers now. And I heard the number of them which were sealed, and there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. And it goes on to talk about all the tribes down to verse 8. Okay, there's a sealing that goes on. In that sense, you could say they might be those who have been delivered. But there's further. Verse 9 goes on. After this, I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands, and cried with a loud voice, Salvation to our God which sits upon the throne, and unto the Lamb. And all the angels stood around the throne and about the elders and four beasts, and fell before the throne and on their faces and worshiped God. Who are these people? It goes on down to verse 13. And one of the elders answered, saying unto me, What are these which are arrayed in white robes, and whence came they? And I said unto him, Sir, you know. And he said to me, These are they which came out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Now, when you go back and consider who the people of Daniel really are, who the peoples are, it's not just the Jews that he was concerned about in his day. That's the part of the Daniel prophecy of the future that was so disturbing to him because it didn't make sense in the context of his life. Look at what it says here in verse 2. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. This is back in Daniel 12, verse 2. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. So what Daniel is seeing is not limited to the Jews of his day. There's a resurrection talked about here. And the book of Revelation talks about two resurrections. Clearly, the 20th chapter of Revelation identifies. So, what Daniel is seeing and why he could not comprehend it, and why we sit in such a precious seat to look back and see what he saw and to understand it better than he understood it, is because we also have been given the promise of deliverance, just as Daniel was given promise of deliverance of his people, and the people he assumed were just the Jews. That assumption extended all the way into the New Testament era. Don't you realize that there were those who had a problem with the Gentiles being welcomed into the faith? Because there was an assumption that God's people were only the Jews. And yet, through Cornelius and through Peter and through all of the things that happened, God kept revealing, even to Daniel, that my people, your people, consists of more than just the people who are your kindred. Now, that's revelation of God's great salvation. And Daniel wasn't getting it. What does it say in verse 3? And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. And they that are turned, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. What's the job of the people of God? To bring people to repentance, to turn their hearts to God. And the promise is that we will shine like the sun in white raiment. We read that back in chapter 9 of Revelation about these people who are part of this crowd of folk who are given the great blessing of being with the saints. So Daniel is seeing something here, and the experts really have a trouble with this because they want to limit what's described here to just the Jews. They want to limit it because they want to insist that the resurrection talked about here can't be for the saints of the New Testament era or the church, because the church has already, in their estimation, been carried away. They have been raptured away. So to find in the Old Testament a description of a resurrection of saints, of people, well, it has to be something different. Let me read you what my Scofield Bible has as a note on this resurrection issue verse 2 about those who were asleep in the dust and who shall awake. It says, this resurrection concerns Daniel's people, the Jews. It's selective, not all, but many, restricted to those written in the book. The latter part of verse 2 may be rendered as follows. So they're going to give us now a new way to understand it, because you can't understand the way you read it right there in the scripture. I mean, it seems clear because we have the luxury of the New Testament. We have the luxury of 1 Corinthians 15. We have the luxury of 1 Thessalonians 4. All of the things that describe resurrection and the order of it and everything, we have that benefit, but they're going to tell us you can't believe what you read. So here's how you could translate this according to the Scofield people. These, and then they put a parenthetical statement, the ones who awake, to everlasting life. But those, parenthetical statement, those left in the grave who are yet to awake, to shame and everlasting contempt. This resurrection will occur after the tribulation and concerns Old Testament believers and tribulation believers, not the church, which will be translated before the tribulation. They've got to have that rapture, you see. So they insist that you can't understand with your own eyes what you read in Daniel 12 and verse 2. It has to mean something different, because we Christians of the church area have to be special. We have to have this special deal. We can't be lumped in with those Old Testament saints. And yet, that's exactly what Hebrews 11 tells us. We are lumped in with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We are lumped in with Daniel and David and Sarah and Rahab. Why? Because we are connected to them by what ingredient? Faith. There is no distinction. God doesn't make a distinction of having this separate little resurrection. And this Schofield goes on with a note in 1 Corinthians 15 about the resurrection to show how there were Old Testament resurrections and how Jesus' resurrection was distinct, and that there were people who were resurrected at the time of Jesus' death. But there are these two special resurrections that come later on, because they have to hold to the notion of this speciality about this rapture circumstance. Well, that's not what we see here in this passage. So, the three verses that conclude the presentation to Daniel conclude with this idea of a resurrection. Now, we could go to 1 Corinthians 15. Well, let's do it quickly so that we know that the New Testament gives us information. And it explains what Daniel could not understand. 1 Corinthians 15, the resurrection chapter, in verse 52. It says, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trump shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. Now, in Paul talking to the Corinthians, he doesn't explain to them in depth as he does over in 1 Thessalonians 4. Let's turn over quickly to that. And we're grateful that Paul understood these things and wrote to these congregations, because it helps us understand. Chapter 4 of 1 Thessalonians, and let's begin in verse 13. But I would not have you be ignorant, brethren, concerning them which are asleep. Well, the people that Daniel was shown were also asleep. He was told that they're going to sleep, but they're going to awake. So, whoever these people are fit into the category of that Paul is going to describe. That you sorrow not even as others which have no hope. Verse 14, for if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, them also which sleep in Jesus will God bring with him. For this we say unto you, and by the way, sleep in Jesus, we mustn't run by that so quickly, because Yeshua, the name Jesus, has a serious meaning. It has to do with salvation. You see, Yeshua, the Savior. Now, we think of Jesus as being a New Testament character, a New Testament concept. But in fact, throughout the Old Testament, salvation is present throughout God's dealing of bringing salvation to the people even before Jesus comes, because the thing that saves Abraham and Isaac and Jacob is their ability to see the future. The promise to Abraham was that you're going to have a seed, and that seed is going to be a blessing to all nations. And it wasn't just talking about Isaac, it wasn't talking about Jacob, but he was talking about Yeshua, Jesus, who was to come. So there had to be knowledge about this salvation through this Yeshua, the Savior, in the Old Testament, that caused them to believe and to be faithful and to be counted worthy of a resurrection. That's the promise that Hebrews 11 talks about. So continuing on here. For this we say unto you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord shall not prevent or precede them which are asleep. For the Lord shall descend from heaven with a shout, and the voice of the archangel, with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. The dead and the anointed one shall rise first. Then we shall all, then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. Comfort you with these words. Now, if Daniel could have had a presentation to him by maybe Paul, perhaps he would have understood. But probably not when you consider the curiosity that he had about his people, his notion of what his people meant. It was greater than he thought. For we have that revelation now to us through the book of Revelation, through the things that Paul wrote, that the people of God were ever intended to be greater than simply the Israelites. It always was intended that the Israelites, what do we read here? And they, in verse 3, they that turn many to righteousness are the stars forever and ever. The intent was that Israel was to bring people into a relationship with God by example of showing how a relationship with God would bring great blessing, great benefit, and that ultimately God wants to share of himself with those who come to righteousness. But Israel blew the job. And so the New Testament era comes along with the church being charged with that responsibility. Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel, the good news. Share the good news. Make converts. Make disciples. That was the intent of the New Testament church, to replace what the nation of Israel did not do. Daniel is able to look at these things but not understand. Look at verse 4 now, back in Daniel 12. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end. As I said earlier, Daniel did not see Alexander the Great, did not see Antiochus Epiphanes, did not see the battles of the king of the north and the king of the south at all. He was long dead. Did not see the coming of Jesus Christ. Was not around during those times. And yet, he's told to shut the book up to the time of the end. And then comes this little caveat. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. I don't know of a time. I don't know of a time, even though Daniel had access to the libraries of Cyrus and of Darius the Mede, and he didn't have access to information like we have today. I mean, think about where we live, at the time in which we live. Is there a future time that would be more staggering? Well, I suppose to some degree, because it's all relative. But the instant communication that we can have, in this office complex, we've got computers that can tap into the internet, you know, if you can get online, and access information all over the world about any subject that you want to proffer. So when we describe the time of the end, and then Daniel is told to seal up this book, seal these words up until such a time, for knowledge shall be increased, and that people will be running to and fro. And I used to think, running to and fro, does that mean getting on a plane? Well, that's one way of running to and fro. But if you can access the internet, you can run to and fro all day, all night, 24/7, 365 days a year. What a time. But you can see why Daniel will have a problem understanding, well, what do you mean? Knowledge shall be increased and people will be running to and fro. How is Daniel to understand such a thing? We can understand it because we live in such a time as this. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two, talking of angels, one on this side of the bank of the river and the other on the other side of the bank of the river, and he's in a castle or a palace on the river in the Persian part of the empire. And one said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? That's right. How long? So we ask that question today. If Daniel is sealed up to the end, well, how long before these things happen? Because what we read in the 10th and 11th chapters of Daniel did have a prior fulfillment with the Greek Empire. Remember, Daniel sees the vision of the ram and the goat, in chapter 8, and he's told that the ram represents the Greeks to come, represents the Persian Empire, and they're going to fall and going to be replaced by the goat. I may have it reversed, but you can check me out on that. But one of these animals will be victorious over the other, and they represent the Greeks, and one represents the Persian Empire. So he realized that that was going to happen through the vision, but there was so much he didn't comprehend. So now he goes on, and we read these words. And I heard the man clothed, verse 7, in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, which he held in his right hand and in his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that lives forever, that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. Now, we all know, biblically speaking, that that's 3.5 years. A time is 1 year. Time is 2 years, that's three. And a half a time is a half of a year, so that's 3.5 years. That's the accepted explanation that's found throughout the Bible, because this is not the only place this expression is used. In fact, back in Daniel, the 7th chapter in verse 25, just to refresh us a bit. I think that's what I want here. Daniel 7:25, and he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and there shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of times. And my marginal note tells me that this is a reference to the 3.5 year reign. Now, 3.5 year period. Well, 3.5 year period, okay. When do we start counting that period of time? That's the big question. Remember I mentioned that we in the Worldwide Church of God had said in 1972 was when we started counting the 3.5 years, and by 1975 Jesus would be on the earth. Well, see, we had concluded by doing a mental gymnastics with math that the 3.5 years started in January of 1972. And 3.5 years later would put us into 1975, and Jesus would stand on the earth. See, you can take 3.5 years and put them wherever you want to. What Daniel does not tell us is where to start counting. Well, it tells us in some sense where to start counting in the latter verses here, but people have tried to count those 3.5 years in all kinds of ways, and they've all come up with zero. That's a great lesson to learn. All right. And I heard, but I understood not. See, I kept saying to you that Daniel didn't understand. He didn't get it. He was confused by the things he saw. So he says, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? Fair question. And since Daniel was told to seal the book up and that it would become more apparent in the end of days, you would think that then we would have a greater understanding of what it means and when to start counting and all those kinds of things. And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed to the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. What are we to understand, wise guys? What are you to know about all this? I tell you, you know, racing through, well, it hasn't been a race, it's been a tortoise race for 2 years to go through the entire book of Daniel. But what are we to know about these things? From the time that the daily, verse 11, from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he that waits and comes to the 1,335 days. Oh, I love these numbers when they get thrown around like that. What? 1,290 days. 1,290 days. And then you got 1,335 days. What does all that mean? How do we to understand that? It's just kind of thrown in. Well, the commentators and everybody really wrestle with that, and I've heard people who claim to know what it all means. Let me share with you the marginal reference here from what the Scofield Bible has. Three periods of days dating from the abomination exist here, and it gives us the three of them. The first one, 1260 days to the destruction of the beast. Okay, when do you start counting? That's the question. There are no sacrifices going on in Jerusalem that we know of, because if the sacrifices start, there has to be an end, and from the end of the sacrifices, you start counting. Well, that hadn't happened yet, but people get to counting and putting times on days, and none of the events have happened to give you the reference point. Anciently, there was a cessation of sacrifices at the temple under Antiochus Epiphanes in 168 B.C. Well, that's a long time ago. But we are not in a place yet, and when you start seeing sacrifices in Jerusalem, then you start looking for an end of the sacrifice, then you start counting days. But prior to that time, it's foolish to be trying to count and pinpoint. Now, should you pay attention to the events of Jerusalem? Yes. What are they doing over there with the red heifer? What are they doing with the idea that Shimon, the gentleman who caused the riots by walking up into the Dome of the Rock, the general of Israel, I can't remember his name offhand right now, but he went into the situation, and the fighting that has happened in the wake of it is a result of his going to the Dome of the Rock, the holy place of the Islamic people, and they don't like that, and so there are little battles going on. But there is no temple, there is no tabernacle, there is no sacrificial system yet in place. So you do watch for that event. And then you start to reckon, well, when I see that happening, I better be wise. I'll have some understanding. This is what is being given to Daniel. So he's been giving these numbers to consider. This first one, the 1260 days, this is also the duration of the Great Tribulation, some say, dealing with the 3.5 year period of time, dating from the same event as a period of 1290 days, an additional 30 days. That's what verse 11 tells us. And, let's see. And again, 45 days are added. So you've got 1260 days, 1290 days, and then 1335 days. So these things seem to be successively applied. What they all mean is your guess is as good as mine, because until I see sacrifices and an end of the sacrifices, these dates, these times mean nothing to me. They have a historical application. You can go back and count, and from 168 to 164 B.C., rather, and you can see that it all fit anciently. But there's a future application. There's a time coming when there is going to be a resurrection, but it's preceded by these events, because the question is, when will be the end of these things? When will we have this resurrection that you talked about earlier in this 12th chapter? When is that going to happen? And it won't happen until the sacrifice has been set up, the abomination of desolation occurs, and then comes the counting of the countdown, if you will, to the return of Jesus Christ. Now, some say during that period of time of this tribulation period, this time that's described in this chapter as the worst time that has ever been, some say that the saints have been carried away. They've been raptured away, and they're just watching all of the chaos on the earth. Well, we have taught and consider that that is not the way it's going to happen. Jesus Christ coming to receive his saints will be very visible, very obvious, and very, shall we say, a herald event. But look at verse 13. But go you your way till the end be, for you shall rest and stand in your lot at the end of days. Daniel, go your way. You're going to die before these things happen. You're going to rest. That's what it means. But you're going to stand in your lot. This is a resurrection. The righteous resurrection at the end of days. He's promised a resurrection. That's quite a promise to have. But he will not see Antiochus Epiphanes, nor will he see what happens at the end of days. He's going to be resurrected in his lot. So what do we learn? In the book of Daniel, one of the things that has come clear to me is not the prophetic intent of the book. It is the relationship that Daniel has with God. It's what the saints should have. In the Word Biblical Commentary, interestingly enough, on this last verse, this is what's written. It says, the faithful are challenged to steadfastness. That's what the book of Daniel is about. Whatever comes, whoever is in control, whoever our next president is, you must be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the Word of God. So that, what was the purpose of offering people all this quasi and actual information about the future? What was the purpose? This is from the explanation here in this Word Biblical Commentary on Daniel. It's wonderful. Information as such does do people some good. Then it has its parenthetical statement. The Gnostics, the people who have knowledge, were not wholly wrong. It helps them formulate a mind on the issues that confront them. But I also want it to influence their behavior. This is written in the first person as if God is talking. I also want it to influence their behavior. I want it to encourage the discerning to be steadfast in their faithfulness and to encourage others to join them. Remember what we read in the 12th chapter? That we are to bring others to righteousness? What's the point? To be steadfast, to be faithful. That's what Daniel was. Steadfast? Well, Daniel, if you are found praying against the king's order, you get thrown in a lion's den. Was Daniel steadfast? You bet. Hebrew boys, if you don't bow down to this image, and we try to figure out, well, the image is this, the image is that, and this image means this, this bird means that. I mean, we just go through all of this meandering. What's the point? Will you be steadfast? Will you bring others to righteousness? That's the point of the book of Daniel. And the saddest part of all of it is that when we consider the point of what Daniel was to learn and what he came to know, the fact that there is a judge coming who will judge whether you are steadfast and faithful or not will determine whether or not you'll be in the righteous resurrection. That's what's important to know about the book of Daniel. Whether you will be faithful as he was and as the Hebrew children were in the face of great difficulty. And it doesn't matter who the king is. It doesn't matter how many wars go raging on or who the beast is and who the false prophets are, who they are. It doesn't matter. As long as you and I are faithful to the God of Daniel, for that God was Daniel's judge, and he is also our judge.